We're taking you behind the scenes with entrepreneurs that run product-based businesses, people that were once in your shoes. Our TSBC alumni, speakers, and friends will shed light on growth strategies, resources, and inspiration to help you scale your creative business. Before we get started, I wanted to invite you to our next PaperCamp conference, which will take place March 14th and 15th in Los Angeles. This is our signature program where we tackle product development for wholesale, sales strategies, marketing to retailers, and exhibiting at trade shows. We will spend 2 days diving deep with you and helping you figure out everything you need to know to build a strong wholesale foundation. We're going to provide you with a ton of resources that took us years to uncover and share our favorite manufacturers with you. And we will welcome you with open arms to our Trade Show Bootcamp family. If you'd like to join us, head on over to tradeshowcamp.com/papercamp and register. Hey friends, I'm Katie Hunt, the founder of Trade Show Bootcamp, and welcome to Proof to Product. This week, I sat down with the founder of Farm Girl Flowers, Christina Stemble. Christina founded Farm Girl Flowers 7 years ago from her living room table. She invested $49,000 of her personal savings to start this business, and Farm Girl Flowers is projected to hit $23 million in revenue for 2018. Christina disrupted the floral industry with new options for consumers, less waste, and higher quality products. Farm Girl Flower arrangements are designed by hand in-house in San Francisco, California. On today's episode, Christina shares a lot of really great information. She talks about why it is so important to know your numbers. She talks about the struggles she's had with scaling and how she's pivoted more times than she can count. She also talked about how she's been proactive about business education and why she's not ashamed to say that she wanted to create, or she set out to create, a $1 billion business. She also talks about why she focuses on caring about people, but not necessarily about what they think of her. Hey, Christina, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am really excited to talk to you. A little backstory here. I was first introduced to your beautiful products in 2016 when I was in San Francisco filming my classes for Creative Live. And a close friend of mine sent a boutique to my hotel. And not only were they stunning, but they made my hotel room feel like I was at home. So first things first, I want to tell you that you are creating a wonderful customer experience with your floral arrangements and also in how you're serving your audience. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, thank you so much. It's the best part about our job, getting to bring joy and love to so many people's lives.
Yeah, I can't imagine all the different unique milestones you're a part of. So what were you doing before you started Farm Girl Flowers? You were in event space, correct?
Yes. I worked at Stanford University. I oversaw an events and programs department for the law school. And that's originally how I even started researching the floral space to begin with. You know, back in 07, 08, 09, you know, that those years were economic downturn years and everybody's budgets were cut, especially in events and marketing in those areas. And so when I was researching what we were spending money on for the events that we were hosting at the law school, I was amazed to find out how much went to the decor at these events and then primarily in flower arrangements that would just go home with people at the end of the night or servers that were working the event. And that took me down this rabbit hole of research into the floral space in general. I very quickly moved from the event space, though, to the e-commerce space, because when I was researching, I was really just kind of flummoxed to find out that the e-commerce space in flowers was actually declining.
And interesting.
Yeah, it kind of blew my mind because every other industry, textiles, food, anything, beauty, every other category, it seemed that was the area that was just explosive growth.
It was booming. Happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't in flowers.
Do you think that was just because logistically it's difficult to do that through tech?
Yeah, I think it's logistically difficult. And I just think the options that were out there were not good options. It reminded me every time I would send my mom flowers in Indiana, I was forced to use one of the traditional e-commerce companies, and I never liked the whole experience. So when I was researching, I found that younger consumers were purchasing flowers less often than previous generations. And the reasons that were given were the same reasons that I didn't want to send my mom flowers from those guys either. Because I spend an hour looking through like 150 to 200 options on their website. I would pick what I considered the least ugly option, usually like an all white bouquet or something.
Right. Oh my gosh, I've been there. Yes.
But then what she would get never looked anything like that. It would be like dyed Kelly green daisies or something that looked like it cost like $8 from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so I just didn't think it was a good value prop for my money. And younger consumers, you know, it's not rocket science what they want. They want something that's beautiful. They want to feel like they weren't ripped off or robbed in the process. They want a good value for the money. They want to be marketed in areas where they are actually at. And then they also just, they want products that are reflective of them as consumers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, an $8.99 bouquet from the grocery store is not representative of them, you know, if they're into style or fashion or anything like that. And it's the same reason that I didn't want to purchase. So I thought, well, if I could fix these problems, this category of sales should not be declining. It should be rapidly growing. And also being in Silicon Valley, it seemed like the last undisrupted space. You know, like everybody was
that
like,
last blue ocean of tech.
I was like, there's, you know, 27 million new box companies or socks companies or toothbrush companies, but there's nobody that's reinvented this space yet. So let me see if I can be the one to do it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Was it like a light bulb moment when you thought, okay, I need to start an on-demand e-commerce flower boutique? Or was it something that just kind of percolated over time? You know, was it a slow process or did you act quickly on it and have the idea quickly?
I acted pretty quickly. It was an aha moment, but to be really fair, I had an aha moment pretty much once a week.
You're a true entrepreneur.
Yeah. I would carry notebooks with me, and every Monday night, girls' night, when I would get together with my girlfriends, I would like be like, hey, what do you think about this idea? Like iron-on pockets for women's suits, or, you know, like it was beta test this for me, or this web set of tools for event planners, or, you know, everything was like a focus group, a mini focus group for me with my girlfriends. And so every week I thought I had the next big, you know, huge idea. So I acted pretty quickly. When I thought of this idea, it was the end of 2009 is when I started researching, early 2010. And I quit my job in June of 2010. I did one focus group before I quit my job. And I thought that was plenty of research to back up and support my, you know, Oprah aha moment idea. Right. And I thought I would have our website up and going and everything done within like 30 days. And it, of course, did not happen. So I got it up November 7th was our launch date of 2010. So I quit in June, had till November, and then went.
Right in time for the Thanksgiving holiday season.
Yeah, although the first year was pretty much just my friends and family buying flowers from me, you know, for the first
same,
2 months.
Same for my stationery business when I kicked that off. Yeah, I totally get it. But okay, so how has this business model changed over the years? Because I assume logistics have changed over the years for you too. So like when you started, were you just doing local delivery or, you know, and now you're doing all across the United States, correct?
Yes, correct. So when I started Farm Girl, I was really naive in many different areas, but one of which I thought that I would be able to get national shipping going within 2 years. I thought, how hard can it be? You put stuff in a box and you ship it. So when I started Farm Girl, it was never with the intent to be a very small localized flower shop. Right. I think that's a common misconception, especially with women in creative spaces. The assumption is that we're not trying to build this big. And my that's an absolute incorrect assumption. My goal from day one was to build a $1 billion company. And I have no qualms saying that. I don't think there's anything wrong as a woman to say that you want to build something big and do it really, really well, and that you want to make money. There's no shame in that.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. So my goal was always to build it big. It took me 5.5 years, though, to get national shipping going. I realized that if it was that easy, everyone would be doing it.
True.
There was a reason why they weren't. It's more of a barrier to entry than I originally thought, which is good for us now. There's more of a barrier of entry for other people, but but it was really challenging. So it took me 5.5 years to be able to get a rate that we could afford to subsidize for consumers. So I had to save a lot of money. I bootstrapped Farm Girl. I had about $49,000 in my bank account, and that's what I used to start Farm Girl. It was in my dining room for the first 2 years, me doing every facet of the operation, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, making all the bouquets, answering all the customer service, doing all the sales, going to coffee shops, putting out flower arrangements, all of that. And then moved into a small space, 1,100 square feet at the Flower Mart, and started hiring people. And then 5.5 years later, I was able to get national shipping going because we subsidized $7.40 per order that we were shipping out.
Wow.
So I had to get to a financial place where we could afford that subsidy, which was the number one thing holding us back from national shipping. So
interesting.
Yeah, I was able to get to a point where we could afford to subsidize every order and still break even every year. Everybody always asks if we're profitable. We have to be profitable. I find it to be the funniest question ever, because when you're bootstrapped, you have to be profitable or you wouldn't be around unless you just you know, run into so much debt, you know, which we don't have, which is good.
I was just going to ask, are you a debt-free company or have you taken on debt at different points to help with scaling?
We have a little bit of debt right now, but it like not much. It's very insignificant. Mm-hmm. We are at the stage where we're now so big that we have to prepay for some things, but takes, you know, 4 to 6 months. So we're having an inventory cash flow issue that everybody has right now.
I was just going to say, I work with a lot of creative entrepreneurs who are amazing artists, but they struggle sometimes with the business side of things. And lately, cash flow has been a very hot topic of how do I maintain this cash flow when I'm also needing to invest in new inventory, people, perhaps a new space, you know, and I find it super fascinating that you started with $49,000 from your personal savings, and now you have projected revenues for this year for $23 million. That's incredible.
Thank you. Thanks. We came in at $15 million. Last year, 14.9. This year's 23. So we're growing as quickly as we can, bootstrapped. All of our growth is very strategic, though. So we could be bigger, much bigger than we are right now, but it would have blown up our operation. So there are times when we have to cut off orders. The first 2 years that we shipped, I could not afford to ship more than 200 packages a day, or we would have lost our shirts. So
okay, wait, let me hold on. Hold the phone. I have never heard of somebody, I mean, that takes amazing discipline too to know, okay, 200 is our cutoff. That's what we can, that's our number to be able to sustain the orders and to be able to get them out, still make a profit on it. So we're not, most people want as many orders to come in as possible and then they try to figure it out, but they run themselves so thin, it cuts into their profit margins. They're running their team ragged. I mean, how did you realize that 200 was your number for the day and learn that you needed to stop?
You have to know your numbers. So this is one of my biggest things. Like as an entrepreneur, you have to know your numbers. You have to know your forecast. You have to know your projections. And you have to go back and check them often. So, you know, when we started National Shipping, when I started shipping to the lower 48 at least,
yeah,
I knew our number was 200. I also, actually it was 50 to start and then it crept up to 200. But we have to go back and check. And what's happening now is that we're growing much faster on very far away places, zones 6 through 8, than we are zones 1 through 4, which is the areas we don't have to subsidize as much. So instead of our subsidies going down, they've gone up, which we would have thought they would have come down, but it's not growing at a uniform pace across the United States. And so if I wasn't in our numbers all the time, I wouldn't know that. But now we're even looking forward to like next Valentine's Day. We may have to cut off certain zones where we just can't afford to ship as many as what we have been. Because, you know, if we're doing it for, you know, our average of, you know, 1600 orders a day right now, that's okay. But if we're doing 8 to 10,000 orders a day, and it is that same amount, that same mix of where it's going, our subsidies might, you know, tip several hundred thousand dollars then in that 1 week, or it will tip several hundred thousand dollars in subsidies in 1 week, which we can't afford to do to pay more than we're making. So we have to know, and we have to forecast, and we have to, you know, we're constantly, you know, analyzing our numbers, figuring out what's going to happen. If this happens, then what? Because we need to have a break even zero, or I can't pay my 116 people that we have on our team. Wow. And so I take it as a big responsibility. I cannot put our company in such an unhealthy place that I can't afford to pay them.
Absolutely. This is very interesting because I was working on forecasting numbers for my business last night, actually. And I've also been working on some of my clients' numbers too. And I feel like that is something very difficult to do when you're a smaller business of the forecasting. I mean, I know when my waves of income are coming in, my business is very different. It's more service-based too. So I can predict certain things with consistency. But at the beginning, when you were starting this business, you didn't have the knowledge base that you have now. So how did you predict these numbers? How did you know which numbers to focus on? How often were you checking the numbers when you were just getting going?
Daily. So it's even more important early on that every day, and you're like, it's a guess and check method, definitely at the beginning. So you're going to make your best, you know, best guess. And then you have to check it so quickly, because even, I think the really great thing about being a small business is the agility that you have. And the, you know, if we even launch a product and it's not selling like we think it's going to, we cut it off immediately. And unlike, you know, larger companies that they don't know for 3 months if something was a success or not, we know that day. Like if we said we're going to sell 700 of this unit and we came in selling 36, let's cut that. Let's figure out if there's any hard goods, how we're going to resell those hard goods in some other way, in other capacity that our consumers, I mean, our consumers tell us what they like and don't like. And so listening to them, seeing what's selling, not selling, and then pivoting so quick. I can't even name the number of times that we've pivoted, because it would be probably over 100,000 times in the last 8 years. So there is a constant. One person on my team several years ago said, every 2 weeks, this is a different company. And I think that is so true, that every 2 weeks, our company looks different than it did 2 weeks ago.
Do you find that to be an advantage or a disadvantage? If do you feel like you're able to keep up with all the changes that you're making, or your team's able to keep up with all the changes?
Yeah, I think it's a very big advantage. I think the fact that we can change so quickly without any red tape allows us to ensure that we are a very healthy, financially healthy company. I also think my new way of thinking about the competition kind of is tied with that. So, you know, I used to get so mad when I would see all the competition that looked strikingly similar, is a legal term that I can use for it. that was very frustrating. And my team now I see gets very, very frustrated by it, especially the people that are responsible, like marketing. And then they'll see marketing ads from competition that looks exactly like ours, or products that we launch for the people that are helping us do our product development here. They're like, you know, they have 2 days and then, you know, five other companies have the exact same product offering. And it's very frustrating for them. And I get it, because I'm, you know, they're where I was maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And right. Now I think of it as, you know what, we actually, that's a really great place to be in. How lucky are we? Because if everybody is making things that look strikingly similar to us and creating businesses that look strikingly similar to us, that means we're the best. You know, that means that we are the best, and we just need to stay ahead of them. And we can do that because we're so agile, and because we can, you know, we can be creative and not have to go through, you know, working at Stanford and working at corporations before that, there was so much red tape and so many approvals and so many check boxes that need signed off on. We don't have any of that.
Yes. I worked, it's funny to hear that you worked at the legal school or the law school, because I worked in the legal industry for over a decade here in LA. And I worked in business development and marketing though, so I wasn't an attorney. But yes, the amount of red tape we had to go through just to get budgets approved or to move projects forward. I will say agility and the ability to just pivot when we need to is such an amazing part of being an entrepreneur. So that it's incredible to hear that you're pivoting as much as you do, because I do think that that's a fear that a lot of entrepreneurs have. They get kind of going in one direction and they think, well, I've put all this time, effort, and energy into going in this direction. How do I now scrap that and change gears?
Yep. I think that we get, it's kind of like when you're dating someone and you've been dating for a long time and you're like, well, I've already invested all this time and I don't want to. And it's like, no, get out. Like, don't waste one more minute, you know? And so like with us, it's like, oh, we put so much time into this thing. It's like, no, it's not working. Like, let's a week from now, we're going to be in the same place and it'll be 1 week longer that we invested into it. So like, let's stop it now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've heard you talk with a lot of pride and a lot of care about your team in a couple of other interviews. What was the very first position that you hired for?
So I had some part-time people that would come and help me like process flowers or answer emails, things like that. But the first like full-time person that I hired was a designer, which was wonderful, because until then, which was at year two, and it was the first time that there was a bouquet made that wasn't made by me. So
was it hard? So it took you 2 years to kind of separate yourself from the day-to-day actual creation of the product then?
Yeah, it took me 2 years to even be able to afford an employee. And at that point, I didn't even know if I could. Right. It was a very scary time. At exactly 2 years in, November 2012, our landlord found out that we were running an illegal company out of a dining room. And so we got the pink slip on the door and needed to move it out. But, you know, I was dwindling down. My $49,000 was almost out. And we, of course, were not at a place where we were breaking even on things yet. And so it was a leap of faith. And so I basically, you know, I signed a very short-term lease where we were moving into. And I didn't know if we were going to be around 3 months from then, you know, because now I was adding $1,100 rent and I needed to hire an employee.
Right.
Because we're at the place where I couldn't get it all done myself. And so to me, I just thought, okay, I've done it as long as I can completely solo. Now I need to bring in help and I need to see I need to see if it's actually a company. If it's not a hobby that I'm just doing in my dining room by myself, but if I can actually make it into a full-fledged company. And so that was at year two. And it was kind of a leap of faith. I didn't know if we were going to make it, at all. And that year was really touch and go in my head. There, you know, I basically felt like I was at the edge of a cliff, just jumping and saying it's going to work or it's not going to work. And that was the year. Let's see, we went from $276,000 is what we did the second year in revenue from my dining room. And that year we did when we moved into our own, our little area of the Flower Mart, we did 920,000.
Wow. Isn't it incredible how in our own head, to use your words, we hold ourselves back sometimes? Cash flow worries are legit. I don't mean to diminish that. But like when we do kind of take that risk, move into a bigger space or hire more people or invest or reinvest in the business, it's incredible how much growth we can have. Did you propel up with your team pretty quickly from there?
Yeah, I think that fear is to your point, is a very powerful thing. And it never is a positive thing, I don't think. And at times when I look back at the worst decisions I've ever made, and I've made a lot of them, ones that I wouldn't consider great ones, they're always, most often they're made out of fear. There's something that I'm afraid of, and that's why I make that decision. So I think that's really powerful. From there, we grew, let's see, from 920 that first year out of the apartment, then we went to 1.9 million. So we were doing 100% growth year over year. Wow. And so our hiring also matched that.
I had to also, scale with that. Hey friends, I know you wear a lot of hats as a small business owner. And while some of those hats are pretty great, others like filing your taxes and running payroll, those aren't so great. And that is where Gusto comes in. Gusto makes payroll, taxes, and HR actually easy for all of us small business owners. They have fast, simple payroll processing, benefits, and expert HR support all in one place. Gusto automatically pays and files your federal, state, and local taxes so you don't have to worry about it. Plus, they make it easy to add on health benefits or even 401ks for your team. Those old school clunky payroll providers just weren't built for the way we're doing small business work today. But Gusto is. And now is the best time to get set up for the new year. Listeners of Proof to Product get 3 free months when they run their first payroll. Try a demo and see for yourself at gusto.com/proof. That's gusto.com/proof. Had you managed people before that?
Yes. So I had managed a lot of people before that. One position I managed over 100 employees before that in a different capacity. I do have to say, it's a very different thing to manage people for a large company where you don't feel the fear of being legally responsible for those people, mm-hmm. and for the good and the bad. So I think hiring was my number one fear at the time, was I don't trust that I'm like, what happens if I hire somebody and they sue me and then it puts me out of business? And I had never been in a position where I was 100% legally on the line and also 100% responsible for their well-being in terms of a paycheck.
I was going to say, that's the part that's been scary to me too, of like, okay, you know, we have to do well because we've got all these people that we need to.
Yeah. And your decisions, like if I make a bad decision, it impacts the ripple effect. It impacts every person on my team. And so that ownership and that responsibility is really hard. And it weighs very heavy on me to think of, you know, as we hire more and more people, I think we'll probably be at about 140 by the end of this year. That's a lot of paychecks and a lot of people who depend on me for their rent. And in San Francisco, rent is really expensive. And so I'm actually really proud that we've never paid people late. We've never not been able to pay. And that's probably one of my biggest, you know, sources of pride, which sounds really silly because of course you shouldn't have to pay people late. But I know many people that have had to and being entrepreneurs. Right. And so I made a commitment that I was not going to pay myself until I got benefits for my team. And so I just started paying myself maybe 2 years ago. Wow. And so I was really proud of the moment that we could do full benefits and get a 401k for our team and things like
that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really great. Can we talk a minute about your marketing strategy? I have been really impressed with the way you communicate with your audience and engage with them. Do you have an internal team managing your social media marketing, or do you do that yourself?
It's kind of a joint effort. So we don't have, and we, to say that we have a fully optimized marketing team would be the most facetious thing that could ever come out of my mouth. So we do not. We have no marketing team at all. My husband works in marketing, though, so at a tech company here in the Bay. And so that's been helpful, definitely. So he'll help set up ad sets for me. And then I can just input the creative into it. So it's one area that he can help me and take a little bit off my plate, which is great. I also have one internal person that works part-time that does a mix of creative for marketing and sending out the marketing email. She sends out the 2 emails a week that we send out to our customer base. It does a phenomenal job of that. She just took that over this year. So that's been another big, huge thing off my plate, which has been great. Until this year, I did all of it. I still post 95% of our social media posts I post personally. And then I have an internal PR and partnerships person. And then person that does our marketing emails that helps. They do stories, our Instagram stories and stuff. It's kind of a little bit. We also have a really amazing video team member that takes videos in our shop and of our products and stuff and DIY tutorials and stuff. But it's very hodgepodge. It's not a marketing department. It's a hodgepodge of we all wear lots of hats. We're still in the like generalist phase. We're quickly needing to go from generalists to specialists. We're not there yet. But in the next 12 months, that's one of the main goals that I have for myself is just to transition my team to be more specialist. But for right now, everybody does at least 7 things.
And from the outside, it does not look hodgepodge, just so you know. And the other thing I was going to comment is, you know, I still do all my social media because I want to be the voice of the brand and I want people to feel connected and know that, you know, they're speaking and hearing from me. Again, it's slightly different because of what I'm offering, but I completely understand. There's certain things that are harder for us as entrepreneurs to give up to somebody else for various reasons. And so it sounds like, was this one of the things that's been a little more difficult for you to give up?
Yeah, I probably actually, I don't anticipate ever giving up probably fully, like the actual posting. I like that that's in my tone. I don't understand like when it doesn't make sense to me to use an agency or an external. And I don't think I would ever use any external companies for that because how would they know? Like, I think part of the thing that makes us part of our moat and the thing that makes us different and more special than our competitors, in my opinion, is that we have a heart. Like we are actually in our warehouse. I'm looking out right now at our warehouse and we have, you know, over 100 people that are making bouquets and loud music is playing and they're having fun. And it's, like, we're the only flower company that makes the product in-house. Most of them are made in South America or Mexico. And so I think showing that heart to our consumers really sets us apart because we're an actual authentic brand. Yep. It's not commercialized in any capacity. So I think I'll always probably keep that. I do have team members that will go and answer everybody's questions and stuff just because I don't have time to then go through every picture respond to 100 or 200 people each day. So they do that. And it's wonderful to have that support now where I do have help doing that. But I think the actual like post, I'll probably always do.
Yeah, I was going to say the content, the direction of the content, the messaging, you know, the vision, the mission, all that stuff needs to come from you. But somebody else can post it and schedule it and, you know, lay it out and do all that for sure. So what did success look like to you in those early years and how has that changed to now?
So I think that's a really great question and it will probably constantly be changing and evolving. But some things stay the same. So then and now, when we were doing 1.9 million in sales and when we're doing 23 million in sales, the number one thing that is to me means that I'm being successful is that I don't run out of money. So I don't know that that will ever change because it's the hardest thing that I do is to not run out of money. That is the absolute hardest thing to do, to be able to grow at least 50 to 60% clip. Is my goal is to always have at least a 50% growth and do that without running out of money or putting my company at financial risk and to be unhealthy is very challenging. So that's number one point of success for me is to not run out of money. I think
fair enough.
Yeah, I think I used to think of success as a number, like I need to get to $1 billion or at least 300 million somehow got into my head a couple of years ago. It's like, I need to at least, that was like a smaller chunk than the billion. So I was like, I need to get to 300 million. And all my financial models showed that I could do that if I brought in this outside investment and stuff. So I think that got in my head. Now I think there is a number value. I don't think that I'll ever be content with our growth unless I hit at least 100 million. So there is that just because it's such a momentous thing to do. Especially if we could do it bootstrapped. I just think that would be really rad. That would be like amazing. But I think more so success means to me is growing a company that I feel proud of. And I think, you know, I've always said my goal is to build a company because – you know, I have a very different pedigree than anybody else that I know, pretty much. I didn't go to college. I don't have a fancy, you know, MBA or anything like that, or really, you know, I think that helped me because I was just a lot more naive. But so when I'm thinking about like how to make decisions early on, you know, it was kind of like a golden rule thing for me. I was like, okay, well, if I just build a company that I would want to work at and I would want to buy from and I would want to sell to, you know, that covers all three. Like that covers my team, that covers our consumers, that covers our vendors. So if I can do those three things, then I think that I will consider this a very successful venture and a very, I'll consider myself a success even if I can do that.
Yeah. I love that because I do think as entrepreneurs, we do need to know the numbers. We need to look at the numbers. We need to know our projections and all of that. But at the same time, it does tie back to what are our core values? What do we want this business to do? What kind of impact do we want it to make? Also, what kind of lifestyle do we want to have? And that's not to say, you know, entrepreneurship is all like Fridays off and relaxing, right? We're all working.
I'm the opposite of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And I am too. And most of us are. But my point is, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what entrepreneurship is.
And definitely. So
I think if we focus on building a business that we believe in, that has the core values that really mirror our own personal core values, then, you know, that'll breed success too.
Absolutely. Okay.
The fact that you don't have a college degree and you don't have like an MBA, but the way you talk about these numbers and business growth and business concepts, it appears as if you do. How did you learn all of those things? Were you self-taught? Did you have mentors? Did you take any types of classes?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely no excuse to not learn now. I mean, we don't even have to go to a library anymore. There's anything that we could want to learn is now at our fingertips.
Yep.
And so when people make excuses about not being able to do things because they've never been taught, I think it's all about your self-motivation. And I do think, you know, there's something to be said. I think that I was blessed with the ability to think critically about things, and that might not come naturally for some people. And so I'm not trying to say like everybody's at the same level, a playing field of what they can and can't do. I think that, you know, I feel very blessed to be born with the skills and the things that I was born with in an area, you know, and also be born in an area where I had the opportunities available to me to do it. Mm-hmm. However, I think that if you're using that as your excuse to not do something, that it's not valid. It's absolutely not valid. It's kind of like in the movie Good Will Hunting, when, you know, Matt Damon's kind of, you know, making fun of the frat boys at the bar and is like, you know, good job on that, you know, $150,000 student loan when I, you know, paid $2.35 in late fees at the library, you know, to learn the same things. You know, I read a lot. I take, you know, online classes a lot when I need to learn how to do financial models. I take Lynda classes. I take all kinds of classes on how do I do that.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. And then just practice. And then, you know, there's nothing I like more than working. I love working on our financial model now. It's one of my favorite things. I also love to, like, I'm kind of the dork that on like weekends when I just went, you know, I'm watching a movie, I'll like get out my model and I'll put in all kinds of numbers that just show like crazy growth. Like when we're doing $1 billion a year, what that actually looks like as far as how much labor we need and how many team members we'll have and all that. And so I think that you can learn anything you want just on the internet now.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with you. You've talked about a lot of different lessons you've learned throughout your entrepreneurial journey. Is there one that stands out to you as just a really critical or pivotal moment in the growth of your business or you as an entrepreneur, your growth?
Lots of them. There's been lots and lots of lessons. All of the lessons, all of the mistakes that I've made, the number one thing that I've learned from it is that it doesn't matter if you make mistakes. The only thing that matters is that you get back up. That's it. Everybody's going to make mistakes. I just spent the last 2 days in court. You know, everybody's going to make mistakes that might lead them to court, might lead them to, you know, a financial crisis of sorts or things they need to bounce back from. And I think the only thing that's important is that you get back up and you do it better. So there have been things like, you know, in 2016, I think my biggest failing that year, at least, was I consider that the year of just keeping up was kind of my mantra. We went from 4.4 million in revenue the year before to 10.2 million that year. And it was crazy. It was nuts. It was, you know, we got kicked out of our space and had to move into a new warehouse 2 weeks before Mother's Day. We didn't have a cooler for Mother's Day, which is imperishable product, like horrible.
Right.
My team I burnt them out. I just completely burnt them out. I have the best team. I can't even say enough about my team. And mm-hmm. they are always willing to do more and do more and do more. And I, as the leader, didn't cut them off when I should have. And I should have known better than, you know, even if they're more than willing to say, like, let's go move. And then let's do Admin's Day that, or Admin's Week the next week and Mother's Day the next week. I should have known better as their leader to say, that's going to burn them out. There's no way that we can do that and do that successfully. And yet I still did it. And so
how are you, okay. So you had that happen. How are you now shifting for looking ahead to, you know, are there signs or are there different things you're doing to make sure that they're taken care of and they're not burning out and you're not running them thin?
Yeah. So I think that year I didn't spend any time on culture. That was my biggest failing, was like, I spent zero time on culture. I thought, gotcha. Hey, we are paying above minimum wage. We have benefits. We have, you know, what more could they want, you know, kind of thing. And didn't spend any time on culture. And that was the wrong thing. And so I had to slow us way down after that. And, gotcha. You know, basically do a huge assessment of like, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? How are we like communicating that to our team members? You know, I was hearing that there was no communication and, you know, we had doubled our team in the span of 6 months, and that's really hard to do and still stay, you know, keep the culture where you want it. And so we didn't. And so I didn't do marketing ads for a while. We slowed way down and reassessed and then implemented, you know, we hired a people and culture manager. We, you know, implemented, you know, monthly surveys, did all kinds of, you know, monthly team meetings, town halls. We like did all kinds of things to change the culture around and also ensure that we had better hiring practices to get people that would be great for our culture as well, instead of just hiring anybody who would come work with us, which is pretty much what we were doing before that. We just needed to do a lot of things differently. And I'm sure that we will go through moments where our culture isn't great again. It's not there right now, and I'm extremely happy about that. Mm-hmm. We need to keep our eye on the ball and make that a huge priority all the time, instead of thinking, well, now it's great, so now we can sit back on our laurels and not do anything, because that's when it's going to slip again. And so I, you know, needed to learn from that, and I did learn from that, and I had to slow us down because of that and get us to a place where then we could up the scaling again and the growth again and do it in a healthy place with people that aren't burnout. And I also just need to be the responsible party that when my team members, you know, want to take on more and more and more, I need to tell them no. And so it's, I don't know many entrepreneurs or many people that I know that are telling their managers, like, I need you to work less. I need you to go home. I need you to like not want to push and push and push to do more products and more projects every single week. We need to take it slower so people can catch up and sleep a little.
Okay, but I want to go back and remind you of something. Scaling a business is freaking hard, and as an entrepreneur, when we're talking about scaling, we're not just talking about the revenue numbers. We're not just talking about the number of people. We're talking about like your product categories, your manufacturing partners, like all these different pieces of running this business are going through massive changes. So I just want to give you credit for acknowledging that there's a certain area of your business that wasn't working as well as you would have liked it to, and that you did something about it. Because I sometimes feel like we get pushed against a wall, and then that's when we take action on it, or we see, oh gosh, this is like spiraled down way faster, or not even down, but maybe it spiraled up faster than we had control over it. And so I do want to acknowledge too that on this crazy entrepreneurial journey, especially when we're scaling, there are times where we have to like push pause on certain aspects of it. I was doing that recently with our marketing and how we're communicating with our audience, you know, like reassessing and then coming back even stronger, which is what you were doing with your team culture. But it's you're dealing with so many pieces of this business. I just think it's I thank you for sharing that, because it's a vulnerability that so many of us have. And, you know, for somebody listening, it might not have been their people. It might have been their marketing, or it might have been their manufacturing partners, or whatever it might be. But, you know, we're all facing some of that to some degree in different ways. And so, you know, sharing that vulnerable story, thank you for doing that.
Of course. I agree. I think that we're fortunate that we don't have outside investors. I wouldn't say that we're fortunate with that in any other aspect than this, because it's been very challenging. I've tried to raise and have it, and there's lots of ways that it's not helpful. But the thing that it's most helpful in is that I can make the right decisions for my company without worrying that I'm not going to hit a revenue number that I need to, or a target number. So last year we came in under what I wanted to come in for the year at. So we went from 10.2 to 14.9, mm-hmm. Or 14.7, sorry. And that's not enough growth for me. Like, that does not make me happy, that number. But I am really happy that that's our number, because we spent the first half of the year getting our culture back on track, figuring out how we're going to move forward and build a strong, very mm-hmm. strong team. So that way this year we can go back up to a 60% growth and, you know, beat last year by 15% on growth numbers. And so it put us in a much better position now to really like turn on the heat, you know, and we can do it with a team that we can do it with.
Yeah. And would you agree that like you need those core foundational pieces of your business to be strong? I feel like there's a lot of focus on the products and services that people are offering, which need to be strong, of course. But there's also that underlying foundation of building this business, the people, the processes, the systems, all that, the money, like that all has to be strong for the products and the services to succeed.
Yeah. One thing, it's definitely, you know, that old, I don't even know, the thing about the like weakest link in the like, or the, you know, you're only as strong as the like weakest spoke in that wheel or whatever. That's exactly what it is, though. I know it's cheesy, but, you know, if you have one area that's not working, you know, we could have like the best design department in the world and we could have the worst fulfillment department in the world and it wouldn't work. Yeah. Your product looks great, you know, or the best procurement and sourcing and it comes in at 100%, but a horrible design department. Like everything has to work together and every single person is valuable to making sure that consumer that receives our bouquet looks beautiful. It's packed right. If they have a problem, they have a customer service, a great customer experience, you know, with us, that the website's working and they can place their order in 3 minutes or less. I mean, every area has to work in order for us to work.
Absolutely. Okay. If you could go back to and talk to yourself 7 years ago and offer yourself one piece of advice from all that you've learned, what would that one piece of advice be?
You know, it's in an area that really isn't anything to do with success in terms of numbers. I would tell myself to care about people, but not to care about what they think of me.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think I worried way too much about what people thought about me early on. And we were disruptors in this space, which I'm saying that, and I know everybody says that, but we genuinely were disruptors in the space. And we were looked at with a lot of animosity from almost every side. We were changing an industry that didn't want to be changed. And I received a lot of grief and a lot of people that hated me and a lot of animosity coming my way. I made some poor choices out of fear. I'm going on a TV show that did not portray me in a good light. And the hate mail, the rape threats, the craziness that came out, and it really affected me personally, you know? And so now, you know, we still get hate mail. We stand up as a company for what we believe in, and we believe in supporting women, not in a partisan way. However, it tends to fall on one side of the partisan issue. Mm-hmm. And so we will always stand up for what we think is right. And now we get a lot of hate mail for it, and we lose revenue for it. We lose followers for it. And I'm so proud of that, to be honest. And I think there are things in life that are worth that. And now I'm in a place where I can do that without worry about the horrible things that are going to be said about me. Because while I care about people, I don't really care what they think of me.
That's beautiful. I think that's also very hard in a world now where there's so much transparency through things like social media. There's so many people saying terrible things publicly that they would never say to somebody's face. So did you just have to shift your mindset around that? Or how did you rework your thinking around it so that you didn't take it so personally?
Yeah, it's really hard. I have a personal mantra that I tell myself constantly, that just because they say it doesn't make it true.
Love that.
So because we, you know, we get hate all the time. And, you know, I just tell myself that just because I say it doesn't make it true. April Fool's Day, we did a joke that I still love. I've been wanting to do it for years and I didn't have the guts to do it until this last year because I'm finally coming to terms with the fact that I care about people, but not what they think of me. Yeah. And so we put out this joke about that we were going to do our part to even out the wage gap and we're going to pay our male team members 78 cents on the dollar of all of our female team members. And it was just a joke, although it was a tongue-in-cheek joke because it's ridiculous.
Of course.
That still exists. But you know, the hate was crazy. I mean, it was nuts. And there were even like previous employees that came out of the woodwork saying that we don't pay living wages and things like that. Because of course it's San Francisco. And if we paid what most would consider a living wage in San Francisco, we couldn't have a manufacturing facility. Like it's not that we're, you know, it's a very different probably living wage would probably be $70,000 a year in San Francisco. And we can't pay that to box orders and things like that, of course. We wouldn't be in business. But, you know, team members, sometimes it's hard for them to understand, like, the, you know, and I, of course, I first go down this whole, like, let me do some explanation and that will help, you know, and then it doesn't because it never does, right? And
right,
I just ignore it. But so there were some really hateful things viewed about me and personally. And so it's hard when it's like a personal and not your business. It's you personally.
Yeah, and of course,
that's when I came up with that mantra, you know, just because they say it doesn't make it true. And so I tell myself that all the time.
Good. Well, what's next for Farm Girl Flower?
So what's next for us is continue growing. So this year I tried to raise capital again, wasn't able to secure a deal that was good. That was a good deal in my opinion for our company. And that's okay. We're just going to continue bootstrapping. And I'm actually very excited about that because it buys me back 30 to 40 hours a week that I was fundraising.
Pitching and fundraising.
Yeah, pitching and all that. So I actually feel like I've been given this huge gift recently of, like, you know, 2 to 3 hours more sleep a night. It's amazing.
Well, and also the mind space of, like, okay, I don't have to try to bring in a partner that I'm going to then have to, you know, answer to some degree.
Yes. The mental load that has been given, you know, the space in the mental load has been, it's been freed up a ton, which is awesome. We're just going to keep growing. Our next for us is additional distribution centers. So we need to get closer to the end recipient. We probably at scale need to open 7 additional distribution centers.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm hoping we can do 1 every 2 years bootstrapped. We were going to be able to do it much quicker if we brought in outside capital, but that's okay. You know, I'm really excited about the fact that we can continue to make decisions that we think are what's best for the company and not just for a certain, you know, thing that we need to tick off or we need to reach this revenue number, even if it would be better if we didn't this year and did next year. So that's what's next. Next year, I hope to open an East Coast distribution center, and then in 2 years, another one, and in 2 years, another one, and until we can get 84% of our product shipped ground overnight instead of air.
That would be great, too, for that subsidy.
Yeah, definitely. Then we can start making some money. It'll be great.
There you go. You're already making money, and you're doing a great job, but I know what you're saying.
It's a profit, I should say.
Yeah, right. Well, where can people find you online? Where can they check out your flowers and find you on Instagram?
Yep. So it's farmgirlflowers.com is our website. We just did a big product drop for fall. Has some really great products. Christmas holiday season is coming up next, and we also have some great products. We have more products than normal during fourth quarter, like everybody. We have a lot more products to choose from, which is great. And on, you know, through social as well, on Facebook and Instagram. Instagram, we do stories every day. You can kind of see behind the curtain at, you know, our warehouse with our amazing team and what they're doing and doing it so well.
That's awesome. Also, sidebar here, did I hear that you're rolling out an events program?
Yes. We're really excited about this. This is another one of those things, like you said, on cash flow and stuff. We're rolling it out as quickly as we can afford to develop the packaging and pay for the packaging and stuff. So it's slower than what we'd like. And my poor events team has been, like, you know, like, just waiting until we can, like, do a full run of all the boxes and all that. So we are launching, we launched our City Hall package online this summer. We're getting ready to do probably next month our phase one. And then early next year, we'll do phase two. By early next year, you'll be able to go order all of your wedding or corporate event flowers on our website. If you don't want to have 40 consultations back and forth, then we're your people. You'll get a pick between 3 to 4 palettes. And, you know, we have our romantic neutrals and our bold and our moody palettes and things like that. It'll still be the farm girl style where you won't pick the actual flower varieties, which is how we can get our waste under 1%. But you'll be able to buy all of your event needs directly on our website.
That's amazing.
It's called Pop Ship Clink. I should have mentioned that. Sorry.
Pop Ship Clink. Awesome. I'm going to look it up because I host events regularly and I know a number of people that do as well. So yes. Well, thank you for your time today. Thank you for all this great insight about how you've grown your business and what's been important to you along the way. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I had such a blast talking to you.
Hey friends, I started Proof to Product as a way to share all of the amazing things that our alumni community is doing and how they are growing their businesses. Now, you may remember Lisa Sarmento of Tiramisu Papery. She was on episode 55 of Proof to Product. Well, I wanted to give you a little bit more background about Lisa. When she came to our Paper Camp conference, she was selling to approximately 20 stores, and she had 3 main goals that she wanted to hit within the first year. She wanted to refine her wholesale program to reach a wider audience, so she was bringing in new accounts. She wanted to exhibit at the National Stationery Show, which was going to be her first trade show. And she wanted to hire sales reps across the United States. Now, if you've talked to Lisa or listened to the episode, you know that she has a ton of ambition and a very deep purpose for the work that she does. And I had zero doubt that she would accomplish all three of these goals and more. Less than a year after coming to Paper Camp, Lisa's products were carried in 124 stores, including Paper Source. She had added 22 sales reps to her team, and she had successfully exhibited at her first trade show. And today, these numbers are even higher. When I asked Lisa about her experience at Paper Camp, this is what she had to say. She said, "I am very grateful for what Paper Camp has done for me. I can't tell you how much things have changed for the better thanks to your program. The wisdom shared by bootcamp speakers and your encouraging words are a huge part of it. Thank you, thank you, thank you." If you would like to uplevel your business, build or refine your wholesale program, or prepare your company to exhibit at trade shows, I want to personally invite you to join us March 14th and 15th in Los Angeles for our next Paper Camp conference. To learn more and register, head to tradeshowcamp.com/papercamp. Proof to Product is brought to you by Trade Show Bootcamp and hosted by me, Katie Hunt. Since 2011, TSBC has worked with hundreds of product-based businesses to help them uplevel, scale, and build profitable, sustainable companies. You can find our show notes and additional resources at prooftoproduct.com. And if you like what you heard today, please head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a 5-star review and subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode.